Tansay, hello and welcome. You're listening to the voices of our people on the Wind Speaker Radio Network. I'm Daniel Barker Tremblay, Nitsigatsun. On today's episode, I continue my conversation with Conrad Plews from Amaskwichiwasahigan, Edmonton, Alberta. Lots of other Indigenous artists' artwork being showcased, whether that be in City Hall, on building walls, whether that be in the bridges here in the city, just to see that uprise in Indigenous culture being showcased within art. What does that mean to you, and what is your thoughts on all that, seeing this big uprise in Indigenous art being showcased like this?
I love it. I think it's amazing. It really makes my heart soar, I guess, to see that, to see so many artists being able to express themselves, to put out some positive imagery and positive expression. I know sometimes it's hard right now over the last few years, especially with all the, you know, the different things that have been hitting the news with regards to, the residential schools and the, murdered and missing women. Sometimes it feels like there's not a lot of positive things. So when I see those things, I like that it shows that we're thriving. We haven't been beaten down, that we're pushing forward and we're creating great stuff. Stuff that everyone wants to see, not just us, and that's what I think is super important, is that we're making our mark known, not just locally but internationally. Where people seek out this art and they love it, and it really draws people together, I hope. So I think it's great, and I hope that trend never ceases and that it just grows.
And of course, as you touched us on a little bit earlier ago, is that you are also doing a lot within the community when it comes to fundraising and stuff like that, with which, by the way, you have another fundraiser that's going to be coming up here soon. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, actually, we are doing a tattoo fundraiser this very weekend for the Institute for the Advancement of Aboriginal Women. So they work with, obviously, Indigenous women. And they do a variety of things. So we try to partner up every once in a while with a group that, we try to do stuff that's local, and do a little fundraiser where the proceeds go to that charity or group. And that's who we're doing this weekend for. That's all Saturday and Sunday.
And of course, when it comes to giving back to the community, whether that be what you've done with the Elks, to the fundraisers that you've been doing, what are some stories that you've had, experiences you've had from people when they approach you and go, like, thank you for doing what you're doing? What are some stories that stand out to you that really impacted you for in your life for the better?
Well, a few years ago, when we started really taking these fundraisers seriously, we came across a story about a little girl, not even about 1 year old, and she had this life-threatening disease that if she didn't get this multi-million-dollar treatment, she would die by the time she was two, thereabouts, that her life expectancy was very short. And they were doing, the parents and their family were doing a multitude of you could tell they weren't spending 1 minute asleep. They were only focused on getting any bit of money they can. So we're going to do some fundraisers for them. For what they needed, it feels like just a drop in the bucket, but we felt we need to get behind this. And we did, and we were pretty successful, and they brought her in. She's just the sweetest little thing. And we got to know their family. And even their family, luckily they won the treatment, that the company does give away a certain amount of treatments every year. And now I believe through some of the lobbying they've done, it's actually the Canadian government is paying for it now. So her life is saved. She's got to be 4 or 5 now. So we still follow her on social media, but her grandmother comes to all of our events. She supports all our fundraisers. And I remember I think it was her mom who was saying, like, this of all the people, like, this was the coolest fundraiser they had. She was, cause it was so genuine, I think, and it was easy to see the outpouring of support because so many people came together just to try to, get some help for this little girl. So that was a really cool one for us, and that's ever since then we try to do a few a year, and it's just something that's grown. It's something that all our staff contribute to, so it's become a very integral part of our shop.
And now, since, you know, for the many years that you've been doing tattooing, for 18 plus years, what are some of the coolest people you were able to tattoo within Black Market?
You know, I like to think all my clients are pretty cool. And that's, you know, I think a lot of artists, if you talk to them, that's the best part of their job, is that we, the people we get encounter, you know, you know, there may be in the odds, you know, celebrity or somewhat famous person that we've got to tattoo over the years. But I think in general, what I like most is you do get to be pretty close or intimate with some of these people. You spend some time and you're typically tattooing something that is really important to them. So you get a glimpse at their life and their story. And sometimes, you know, I feel like we're somewhere between a priest and like a barber, because people sit and they'll tell you their stories. So that is, I think I that's what I would say is the best part. But to narrow it down to one person, it's hard to say, you know.
And I have to ask as well, you know, when the news broke out where you were able to design the Elks logo, what was your relative Tattoo Cardo's reaction when you were given that opportunity to do something like that, to have your art be etched into history within the CFL?
You know, the challenging part was we had to keep it kind of under wraps, social media wise and this and that. And I think there was a little thing in the back of my head that said, until it's released, it may not be real. Like this, you know, I didn't want to count my chickens, or however the saying goes, because you never know. Someone would be like, oh, you know what? We've changed our, we're changed plan. And they might've pulled, you know, pulled the plug on it. So I kind of didn't want to get overboard. So I did talk to people about it that I'd seen daily, obviously. And, but it was only within a week or two of the game that where they had it on the field that they actually put it out there, and I knew, okay, it's good. And yeah, Tantu specifically, she messaged me, so that was, I didn't even get a chance to tell her myself. My mom did, so that was pretty cool. I was pretty happy about that, because of course, like I said, she's been a big inspiration, and so she always has nice things to say. She's, you know, we're fairly close, so. It was really cool.
Did she ever almost get you into acting? Like, did she ever approach you and say, hey, you know, there's this, you want to come into acting for a little bit?
You know, I actually was in a couple movies, not because of her. It was just stuff that I fell upon in Edmonton that were happening, especially when I was in my 20s. And I thought it was a lot of fun. I never really took it seriously, like I wanted to be an actor. But I know she kind of laughed, thought maybe I'll get the acting bug. I never did, but I'm a huge cinema fan. And actually, my oldest son, it works in film in Calgary. So I think that, you know, knowing that that's a viable career choice, that he took that. And, you know, obviously, I'm a huge film person. So that did help influence him as well as tattoo. So.
And it's amazing to, you know, to see that uprise as well within that industry, because, you know, with Tattoo and Graham Greene kind of knocking those doors down for a lot of indigeneity to follow in suit. Now we have Reservation Dogs, we had Prey filmed in Siksikan land, and also we've seen North of 60 with Dakota House and, you know, Corner Gas, and so many amazing things that have happened. Even with The Last of Us featuring Graham Greene and a deadly Mushroom and a Cook'em sitting in a cabin with Joel and Ellie, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
But I have to ask as well, you know, has Tattoo ever wanted to ask you, like, has she ever come up to you and say, like, hey, tattoo me?
No, she hasn't. I don't know that I ever will. Her son, Cliff, who's also a pretty a successful actor and playwright and musician, I've tattooed him a fair bit. So, you know, I think that's enough for her. That's as close as she wants to get to it. But of course, you know, I'd be more than proud to tattoo her. I'm not going to hold my breath that she
won't. Just be like, hey, come on, just sit in the chair for 20 minutes. I'll make you look gorgeous. I'll make you look gorgeous. But no, and I have to ask as well, you know, in the realm of art and designing art, have you had youth come up to you and ask you for advice? You know, I know, like, for example, like my girlfriend, she always would tell me, she'd be like, yeah, like I've been, you know, doing, she's only been tattooing for 3 years. And then when I spoke to her about you, she, like, her whole demeanor just, like, changed for the better. She was like, are you serious? I was like, yeah, scroll through your Instagram. And that was, you know, the rest of it was history. And she's excited. She's coming down. But, like, for her and for many others that are, like, starting in the industry of tattoo, what advice would you give to them?
Well, admittedly, we've apprenticed a lot of young people and who have become tattoo artists, and a lot of them still work for us. But any advice I have for any young person who's maybe thinking about tattooing or arts in general, I definitely encourage them to look into education. Not every tattoo artist has art school training behind them, but a lot do, and it does make a significant difference, I think. Because as far as tattooing is concerned, I firmly believe you're only going to tattoo as good as you can be an artist. And the greater of an artist you can, obviously the better of a tattoo artist you can be. But I think that any art field, whether it's, you know, being a visual artist, being an actor, a musician, education doesn't hurt at all. But ultimately, it's just working your trade and your craft every day. It's not something that comes easy, unfortunately. It's something, you know, nothing worth doing is easy. And I think what happens with a lot of artists is that they start out when they're young because they have a natural ability. And I'll say I probably did too. But when you get into the realm of becoming a professional, that's when the work really begins. And unfortunately, a lot of young artists didn't have to work that hard to do some really nice stuff. But then, you know, that when they really have to pick up the pace and put in the hours, that's where a lot of them fall away and don't become, you know, professionals or making a living at it. Not that everyone has to be a professional artist. You know, you can make art for a lot of reasons, for your own enjoyment. You can be very successful that way too. But you know, from my perspective as a tattoo artist, yeah, it's a lot of work. It's, you know, every day you got to push at it.
And I have to ask as well, you know, what you've mentioned earlier that you've watched Ink Master. So in your professional career, what are some like tattoo horror stories where you had a person come in and be like, ooh, that's going to be some work to do cover up. What's some horror stories that you have?
Well, you know, I've done some pretty incredible cover ups. One gentleman who's I've become friends with, he had a huge collection of crazy stuff, you know, and from over 20 years ago, big black tribal and all, you know, and I think he kept adding to this giant piece thinking he might improve it, but he just became unhappier and unhappier. And he told me he's never worn a shirt that showed off that arm in over a decade. And we had a long talk about it. He was very hesitant because he'd spent so much time trying to improve this and without and just it becoming worse. And he eventually allowed me to tackle it. And now I think if you have a hard time finding him with his shirt on, because we, you know, and it was a big, massive piece. So it was one of the most challenging ones I've done. But you know, unfortunately, there are a lot of horror stories out there. You know, luckily myself and a lot of our artists are pretty successful in the cover-up and can take someone's tattoo and improve it or cover it up, or there's a lot of options. And that's pretty gratifying too, to see people, you know, now have something that they're super proud of and not something they're ashamed of.
Yeah. Especially when you get somebody to come in there and they go, oh my God, I got an ex-girlfriend or a boyfriend tattooed on my body. Can you cover it up? That's why, like, my girl, I told her jokingly, I said, my next tattoo is going to be your name inside a heart. And she goes, please don't. So I have to ask as well, you know, in regards to, because I haven't seen a lot, especially within Alberta, but talk about a little bit about like the incorporation of Indigenous culture within tattoos. Would you say some of doing that on people, like especially with from Métis, Blackfoot, Dene, or Stony Nakoda, what are some of your fondest memories of tattooing Indigenous culture with Indigenous people?
Well, you know, to think about it, there's probably quite a few. I know one of the things I started trying to do years ago, which I'd say has been pretty successful, is mimicking beadwork, like that would be on a moccasin or whatever, and giving it that illusion that it's actual beads. And some of my clients, they say people have to come and touch it because they think they could feel the texture. And it's a very challenging tattoo to do something like that. So it's kind of cool to see that I've accomplished that. And I know I've even in the past shown some world famous artists like, hey, this is some of the stuff I was doing. And they were quite impressed by it because it was something that they hadn't seen before. And I started experimenting with that probably early in my career. And now I see that that is becoming a thing that's a little more common. There's actually quite a few artists, even an indigenous tattoo artist, who are doing stuff that is very expressively indigenous. And they're, you know, to the point where I think that might be all they're tattooing, which is great, that there's that much need and desire for that kind of work. I would say they've surpassed even what I do, which is fantastic, right? So it does me glad to see that this little thing that I felt like no one was doing, you know, 15 years ago is something that's a lot more widespread, is becoming an actual, you know, we talk about tattoo forms, like there's, you know, American traditional, black and gray, Japanese, but now we have a legitimate genre of tattoos that are indigenous inspired.
That was Conrad Plews from Edmonton, Alberta. You're listening to the voices of our people on the Wind Speaker Radio Network. I'm Daniel Barker Tremblay. Next, I continue my conversation with Métis Nation of Alberta President Andre Patra.
In April of 2004, you also represented the Métis Nation at a historic Canada Aboriginal Peoples Roundtable that attended more than 20 federal cabinet ministers and 70 Aboriginal leaders from across the country, where you were sitting alongside the Prime Minister and other national Aboriginal leaders, where you affirmed the Métis Nation's commitment towards a Canadian Métis Nation Framework Agreement. Now, when that agreement was brought up and you were sitting, you know, right next to the Prime Minister of Canada at the time, what was all that like? You know, being in that room, you know, talking the brass tacks and making sure things were addressed and making sure things were getting done, with the framework agreement being brought to the attention towards the federal government.
So, Daniel, again, that is not something that I worked for to be, because, of course, I was the interim national president at the time that I sat at that very, very important meeting with the prime minister of the day. Because of challenges within this time, our national body, the president's position was vacated because of the decision to have him removed. And once again, the way our structure works at Métis National Council, there's an interim president put in place, and that president has to be one of the presidents from the provinces, BC, Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, or Ontario. And it was decided by the Métis National Council board of those five presidents. They asked me if I would take on that role, because we were at key points of being able to move forward with major announcements at that time. And so that's how I took on the role of the interim Métis National Council president, to be able to be at that really important meeting. And yes, that was a very important meeting. I mean, that was one of the opportunities where we clearly had an opportunity to voice, and I always say, the vision of our people had in 1928, when they came together and said, we're going to form an association to stand up for our rights, who we are as people, protect that land, work towards education for our people and health for our people. And so to me, a lot of the things that we were still doing today, and that we were certainly doing when I first became the president of the Métis Nation of Alberta and then on to the national level, it was about rights. It was about recognition. And I know at times I said over and over again in meetings, if the recognition is right, everything else will fall in place. We have not been recognized for who we are, and we are proud Métis. We are very proud of our First Nation ancestry, and we're very proud of our European ancestry, but we're neither one of those. We are in the middle. We are the Métis that have got the benefits of both worlds. And that's who we are, and that's what we want to be recognized for. And so that was where my statement continually came from, was if that recognition is right and Canada finally recognizes that they have a responsibility to us as Métis people, just like other Aboriginal people in this country, then things will start falling into place, because we will be able to negotiate with Canada all of those benefits that our people are missing out on. And that's really what started happening in about 2016 when the Daniels case was won. And then we quickly went from there to sit with Canada to negotiate a memorandum of understanding of, and it was clearly about what did the Métis Nation of Alberta want, and so did the other provinces. What did the Métis Nation of Alberta believe were those rights, and what did Canada believe? And of course, we moved from that memorandum of understanding to signing a framework agreement to where we are today, signing a self-government agreement in 2019 that really laid out the recognition by Canada. And then more so in February of this year, 2023, Canada, in this agreement, recognized, we now recognize the Métis Nation of Alberta as the Métis government in Alberta. And that was huge because I believe that's what our people have, however they said it, have worked for all those years. We're 95 years old. And so it was a very, very proud moment to get to, you know, to get to those places, starting with that Aboriginal roundtable that really gave us that opportunity to put our position forward and have people understand why it was so important for us.
And of course, you know, when I first met you in person, Audrey, I was so nervous. When I was told you were going to have to go interview Audrey Poitras, the Métis Nation of Alberta president, I was shaking like a leaf. I was like, man, I have her signature on the back of my Métis Nation card. So I was just like, I was telling myself, I was like, man, like, you know, and of course, the many times I've seen you in my travels, you know, whether it was at Fort Edmonton Park, introducing the Métis section of the museum there, as well as the coverage of the Otipemisgewa, of course, that has happened both in Calgary and many other places here in the province, as well as appearances at Métis Crossing, which, by the way, is something of with the help of you and your team to build to create that amazing space of Métis Crossing. So, you know, with all the travels that you've done and all the things that you've done, including Métis Crossing, what are some of the biggest highlights and fondest memories that you've had where you're like, man, I'm going there today? Like, that's going to be my office? Like, wow, that is amazing. That's amazing. Like, when we started off in your early career, even today, what are some of your fondest memories of your travels?
Yeah, okay. I'll definitely talk about my travels and the greatest places. But first, Daniel, I do want to say to you, I am really, really pleased that you reached out to get your training from Rupert's Land Institute and that you are where you are today. Because to me, that's success. And, you know, I look at that and I say, you know, Daniel has moved along to where he really wants to be, and he does a great job of it. I really enjoy you on the radio. So, you know, I know that that's what it should be about, is people being able to pursue the careers they want, not having to try to fit into what someone else's plan. And I think that's what we've tried to do all along. So I just want to say good on you. And the other thing, I know I'm old when people like you have gone through and trained and now are successful, and I'm still here. So that's a good part, too, because I am getting letters back from students who say, oh, I'm so happy. Now I've finished my training. I'm a doctor, and I'm married, and I have kids, and, you know, all of those wonderful things that we want families to have. So it has been, there's been very, very many good moments in my career, for sure. But as far as the traveling part, of course, Métis Crossing will always be a favorite place of mine, because long before I ever worked at the Métis Nation or became president, when I would go to assemblies or meetings, people would continually talk about how come we don't have our own place to promote us and to join being together in our own place. Look at, and they would use examples like, look at, the Italians have a cultural center. All of those people, other people have cultural centers and we don't. So, I mean, you know, you hear that enough times, it becomes, yeah, why don't we? So when I was still working at the Métis Nation in the finance department, the president of the day had received a call from the family that owned the land where Métis Crossing is today. And he invited myself and one of our other staff to go out with him to have a look at this land. And he was going to see what he could do because, of course, they said to him, we know this has so much Métis history. We came from Ontario. We purchased this land. We know the history of this land. And the husband had had a minor heart attack. And they said, we know that we're going to have to give up our farming here. And we would really like to know if the Métis want it back. We can't give it away, but we believe it belongs to you. That's how the Métis Crossing dream started. And I was only a staff person at the time. And we worked hard with the president to try to find ways, but there was just not the money that was available later on. And sad to say, he was not able to do it, although he always said, we'll keep trying. Well, about 6 months after I became president, that family visited us again, minus father. And he had had a massive heart attack and passed on. And then the lady basically said to us, I don't have a choice now. I have to sell. And once again, I'm reaching out to you first before I go anywhere else. And that was how the dream of Métis Crossing really got serious again and has become what it is today. As of 2005, we had the huge celebration to open Métis Crossing, and it was beautiful. And to today, that's one of the favorite places for me to go.
That was the Métis Nation of Alberta's Madame President, Audrey Patra, on Voices of Our People. I'd like to thank today's special guests for joining us, Conrad Plews and Madame President, Audrey Patra. Tune in next Thursday for more Voices of Our People on the Windspeaker Radio Network.